This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. It's thrilled today to be joined by two brilliant and enterprising lawyers. We're joined by Chris Sabas and Rachel Rose. They're going to talk to us about false claims, what they're seeing in their practices, and a lot more. Rachel, let me ask you to start by just introducing yourself, and then Chris, I'll ask you to do the same.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be back with you today. My name is Rachel Rose, and I'm an attorney in Houston, Texas, where I have my own law firm, Rachel V. Rose, Attorney at Law. My practice focuses on healthcare, cybersecurity, securities law, and litigation, compliance, and transactional aspects of those, including the False Claims Act, Dodd-Frank, and representing individuals before various government agencies. I also teach bioethics at Baylor College of Medicine, and I'm involved with both the Federal Bar Association and civically here in Houston.
Thank you very, very much. And Chris, talk to us about yourself, give us an introduction to you, and maybe tell us what you and Rachel have in common, where you folks work together, and so forth.
Sure. My name is Chris Sabas. I'm a member at Sherrard Rowe Voight & Harbison in Nashville, Tennessee, where I head the firm's government investigations and compliance practice. Before I joined the firm, right before the pandemic, I served for about 9 years as an assistant U.S. attorney here in the Middle District. And my focus is on litigation and False Claims Act cases, particularly in the healthcare realm. Rachel and I met just talking about, cyber fraud and some of our False Claims Act matters, have found that we both have an interest in health IT and how it its role in False Claims Act and fraud litigation.
Fascinating. And you spent almost a decade with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Talk to us about that experience and how it plays into what you look at today and where you specialize today, and sort of what trends you're watching in terms of government investigation and litigation. And then, Rachel, I'll ask you the same.
Yeah, I spent almost a decade there. I was, I did both civil and criminal healthcare fraud and procurement fraud work, though mostly in the civil space. The trends that I look at now are pretty similar, though evolving, to what I saw when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Still a lot of kickback activity. There's a number of active kickback cases that I'm following, including in the Middle District. And I, when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, actually had two of the first EHR-related fraud cases, the cases that resulted in settlements with Morocco Life Sciences and OPCO. And I'm watching a lot of EHR-related activity over the last few years, leading up to and including a notice to intervene this year in the District of Vermont against Modernizing Medicine. And so those are some of the topics that I'm interested in right now.
And take a moment on, what is that EHR related? Why? What does that look like? What do those claims look like?
There's been an evolution in those. They started, the cases that I worked when I was there were related to EHR donation fraud primarily. It was instances where there were violations of the safe harbor and exception that allowed EHR donations to physician practices adopting EHR. It's evolved from there into, there's still kickback activity, obviously, but also, MU fraud, deficiencies in the EHR systems that result in allegations that meaningful use payments were false. We saw that in eClinical Works and the Greenway cases. Practice fusion, I think, was really, it was a global criminal civil settlement a couple of years ago that really moved the needle in this area, because not only did it have those elements, but it also had allegations of what I call substantive EHR fraud, where allegedly the EHR system itself, there were functionalities in the system that were leading to the fraud. In that case, it was kickbacks that were related to physician alerts that were being put into the EHR system that would recommend particular drugs for prescription. And now with Modernizing Medicine, the case that's we're waiting for the government's complaint and intervention now, you have all of those elements again. You have similar kickback claims. You have allegations with regard to not only MU, but also quality metrics being reported and leading to false claims. And you have allegations that algorithms within the system were upcoding EM codes by using improper modifiers and that type of, like I said, substantive kind of fraud within the system.
Fascinating. So when you talk about substantive fraud, more how it works to sort of lead towards upcoding or better billing or higher billing, maybe improper higher billing, versus earlier kickback cases where a health system or someone was giving a practice EHR, making a donation to them or their EHR system like that as a kickback and outside of safe harbor. Rachel, what do you see in this area? Talk a little bit about where you and Chris cooperate or see things similarly. Tell us a little bit about what you're watching.
So my government service is slightly different than Chris's. I worked on Capitol Hill when HIPAA passed in the mid-90s, and then I was at HHS when the High Tech Act passed in 2009. So Chris and I really have a complementary viewpoint between my government perspective and his government perspective. As you know, the government released its cybersecurity initiative, specifically with the Civil Fraud Division, and the formal announcement came in October of 2021. A case that I was fortunate to bring and represent the whistleblower Dr. Sean Lawler on was actually the first settlement by the Department of Justice of a civil cyber fraud case under the department's civil cyber fraud initiative. And what's significant about that is that it is relevant to what Chris just said in terms of the substance. There were not kickbacks in this case, but there were components of the illicit procurement of controlled substances, which, as we know, is a very significant area in the United States as well. The other part had to do with the requirements in the government's RFP and then the subsequent contract for the procurement of medical services and the electronic health records, which obviously accompany patient care. So as part of that settlement, the issues that were found were inadequate technical, administrative, and physical safeguards, which are required not only under what I call the program formerly known as meaningful use, but also in government contracts under the federal acquisition regulations known as FAR. And then in our particular case, there was a specific line item for being HIPAA compliant. So Chris and I are seeing very similar trends, just in two different parts of healthcare, one being government procurement, the other one being your more typical scenario under the current legal landscape, whereby an EHR company needs to become certified with the government. And then under the meaningful use or program formerly known as meaningful use, the providers have to attest that they are in fact utilizing a certified EHR, and then also that they themselves are meeting all of the technical, administrative, and physical safeguards. And the Coffee case out of the District of Kansas is reflective of the latter here in the United States.
I mean, a fascinating landscape of things that are going on. Rachel, what are you most focused on this year? If you had to pick one thing that you're most focused on, you're watching most closely, what's that?
I continue to look at cyber fraud, but in a different context. And because the case is under seal, I can't discuss it further. Also, the more vanilla fraud, as Chris and I have discussed when he and I co-presented, those anti-kickback statutes and the Stark Law are not going away. So unless entities are meeting safe harbors and exclusions, there's still real liability. Another part of that, which was mentioned earlier by you, Scott, was the notion of giving free EHRs or free product in the form of a kickback. The new Stark regs and the new anti-kickback regs, which became effective on January 19th of 2021, actually implemented new safe harbors under AKS and new exceptions under Stark. But just as our traditional Stark violations and AKS violations occur, in order to make sure that you're not as susceptible to that type of violation and potentially a False Claims Act case, you need to make sure that those safe harbor elements are met or the exception elements are met.
Fantastic. It's such an interesting reminder. In the distant past, not too distant past, everything was a kickback case or everything was a billing case. And it's a great reminder that there's still lots of fraud and Stark and abuse, Stark cases out there and lots of investigation and government resources. Chris, let me ask you the same question. Where are you most focused and interested, you know, as we move into the second part of 2022?
I'll give you two particular cases that I'm really interested in. One, I already touched on the modernizing medicine case in the District of Vermont. The District of Vermont has done a number of these EHR-related fraud cases, and they have yet to file their complaint and intervention in that case. I'm really waiting to see that complaint and intervention. I want to see how it compares to the relator's complaint that's been unsealed, and I want to see how it addresses some of the issues that were raised by the court in the community health systems case in the Southern District of Florida, where some of these EHR allegations were dismissed. I really want to see how the District of Vermont frames their arguments and their complaint. The other case I'm looking at, which is a bit off the radar, I think, so far as I can tell, is a case that's in the Middle District of Tennessee here called Care Services Management. Full disclosure, I worked on this case in my private practice briefly. I'm not working on it presently, but it's a kickback case. But what's interesting about it, aside from the technical kickback elements that we're used to talking about, is here you have basically a Medicaid fraud case where the state is making kickback claims based on payments that were made for non-covered services. So you have adult dental services that are not covered by Tennessee's Medicaid program. Patients pay for those services through the IME program required under federal regulations. TennCare specifically does not cover adult dental. And yet what the state is arguing is, since those adult dental services are being paid out of patient funds, it's ultimately down the line costing us money because we have to pay more money toward the living facilities reimbursement for our elderly Medicaid patients. And so I think that's a fascinating case to see how that evolves, because it's in tension, in my view, with some prior law on whether or not IME payments are federal program payments.
I mean, that's actually, some could argue that there's a real stretch there, because if you take that position, that anything that makes somebody poorer ultimately leads them to be eligible for Medicaid, and thus everything's included in Medicaid. That seems like a very strident position.
I would tend to agree with you. I thought it was a interesting opinion when it came out from the court. The section of the opinion that addresses the applicability of the any kickback statute really doesn't cite to any prior case law on this, and to my knowledge, it's something of a one-of-a-kind opinion. And so I'll be very curious to see how that case evolves to discovery and whether that case gets any traction, any citation in other districts. It seems to me there's some logic in there that could seriously expand the scope of enforceability of the anti-kickback statute through the False Claims Act.
Chris, I guess one more question for you. You worked in the Department of Justice through Democratic and Republican administrations. You don't have to comment on this at all, and I truly mean that. Any differences in approach, or is it really the same Department of Justice when it comes to healthcare fraud, healthcare investigations, and so forth? Anything you could share with us there that feels comfortable with for you to share?
I will be honest with you. I did not experience any significant differences in my realm. No, I'm not a policy guy. I was just a line in the USA with my head down, you know, investigating and prosecuting civil fraud cases. I did not see all that much of a difference in the day-to-day there. You know, to the extent that there were differences, there were some differences on a more policy-oriented level. You know, I did do some work during my last couple of years at the U.S. Attorney's Office with regard to the the justice manual provisions that, you know, for lack of a better term, codified the brand memo. You know, very recently, those provisions appear to have been rescinded after the Garland memo rescinding the Brandon Sessions memos. So, you know, in that respect, some of those policy issues, there were some differences. But as far as the day-to-day, you know, white-collar fraud efforts, you know, I got along well with my U.S. attorney. We did good work there in the last couple of years, just like we did during the Obama administration. You know, it was as much business as usual as one could expect, and there was a continued interest in prosecuting white-collar fraud.
And then one more question. You were in the sort of Tennessee area. Tennessee is a hotbed of entrepreneurial healthcare for longstanding. It's sort of the home of originally HCA and then all these companies that came out of that tree of companies. Does that make it more active, U.S. Attorney's Office in terms of healthcare business, because that's one of the big businesses in the area, or not necessarily so?
Yes, it definitely makes it a very dynamic practice. I was one of a couple of new AUSAs who were brought in 2011 when the U.S. Attorney's Office decided it wanted to expand its civil healthcare fraud capabilities for that very reason. It's the healthcare capital of the country. The practice at the U.S. Attorney's Office and in the bar generally down here has grown significantly in the last, you know, 10 years. And so there's definitely a growth there. There's definitely a focus there. It's a really exciting place to practice. And over the last 6 months, especially, and I've written on this on my firm's blog and a couple of articles, there have been some really interesting opinions that have come out of the Middle District of Tennessee as some of these False Claims Act cases that have percolated through the system begin to get litigated post-intervention. So no, it's a very dynamic practice here, and it's growing all the time.
Rachel, give us similar insight on Houston. Houston at one point was thought of as, you know, the Wild West of healthcare. Talk a little bit about what goes on in the Houston market. I mean, it's got some great, highly respected health systems. And then it also is a hub of entrepreneurial healthcare with all kinds of stuff going on. Give us a little bit of insight on the Houston market.
The Houston market's interesting from the False Claims Act standpoint in that there seem to be more criminal actions coming out of Houston, which really isn't surprising, given that when we look at the ZPIC zones, the two hot spots for healthcare fraud are Florida and Texas. So it is very relevant that they tend to have a trend in going after individuals, whether it is for PPP fraud or whether it is for certain types of healthcare fraud. There have been a lot of lab cases out of the Southern District of Texas in particular. If we shift northward slightly to the Eastern District of Texas, we had very significant cases both on the criminal side and the civil side. And one of the cases that stood out was the Texas Heart Hospital case that was initially declined by the government, and the Relators Council went forward, and that case settled for approximately $48 million. And that was premised on Stark and anti-kickback violations. So if we go back to Houston, I'm fortunate to teach at Baylor College of Medicine, and there have been trends. As we know, there are also HIPAA trends that have come out of MD Anderson. There was a very significant alleged HIPAA violation, which ended up being rescinded because of the type of penalties that were assessed against MD Anderson. So I would say that even though I live in Houston, the landscape's slightly different in Nashville. And as you know, Scott, I went to Vanderbilt, so I've spent time in Nashville. That's more entrepreneurial for health systems and more on the provider side. Whereas if you look at Houston, a lot of those corporate entities out of Nashville have hospitals in Houston.
Fascinating. Chris and Rachel, I'm so glad we had the chance to visit together today. Fascinating careers for both you and great insights into what's going on in the healthcare markets and the Department of Justice. Thank you both very much for taking the time to join us. What a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.